Go ahead, Cal. Yeah, okay. I'm good to go.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome. So it's a great pleasure to welcome back to UCLA Jeff Friedman. I think as many of you know, Jeff spent many years here before heading to Cambridge, where he is Stanfield professor of international peace in the Department of Government. His specialty is obviously international political economy. He's got several books of note. I'll mention his latest, Lost Decades, written with Menzie Chin, subtitled The Making of America's Debt Crisis and Its Long Recovery. I imagine we'll draw on some of that today.
Yep.
So we will run for about 75 minutes. Jeff will talk for maybe 30 to 40 minutes, as long as he wants. Questions.
Won't say that.
Plenty of questions. Please raise your hands. You can take your own questions, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
And as I said, we'll wrap up around 4:15. So take it away, Jeff.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Cal. It's a great pleasure to be back here on this familiar campus. We are, as you all know, in the midst of the most serious economic crisis since the 1930s, in the midst of a recovery from that crisis. It was the longest economic downturn since the 1930s. It was the deepest economic downturn since the 1930s. And the recovery has been the most difficult since the 1930s. As I think we all know, the recovery in the United States has been extraordinarily slow, and there are real concerns about whether it is sustainable. Just to give you a statistical sense, if we take the average of all recoveries from recessions since the 19, not including the Great Depression of the 1930s, but since then, typically by this point in the cycle, output would be 15 to 20% higher than it was before the recession. Today, it's barely back to where it was before the recession. Typically, it takes the average recession since the 30s, it takes between 3 and 6 months for employment to return to the pre-recession levels. We are now almost five years past the beginning of the recession, and unemployment is still above 8%, and even the most optimistic of projections are that it'll be at least 2 more years before employment gets back up to where it was before the recession. The usual employment spell in the average recession since the 1930s is a little bit less than 4 months. That is, people laid off, find the new job within 4 months. The average employment spell in this recession so far is 10 months and rising. Right? And that's the good part of the recovery in the United States, where we actually are growing. As you all know, in Europe, which is the other main center of the current crisis, Europe as a whole is more or less officially in the second dip of a double dip recession. And in some countries, that crisis has been much more severe than in the United States and in others. Unemployment in Spain and Greece is now approaching 25% and still rising. Youth unemployment in a half a dozen European countries is above 50%. That is, unemployment among 18 to 24 year olds is above 50%. So this doesn't seem like your typical cyclical recession, the typical cycle which market economies go through every 5, 7, 8 years, where the economy grows and then falls into recession and then it starts growing. It doesn't seem like your typical cyclical recession, and that's because, I would submit, it is not. It is not a typical cyclical recession. It is a much deeper and more serious debt crisis. And the way to think about it, I think, is to think about debt crises we have come to know in the past 30, 40, or even 150 years. That is Latin America in the early 80s, or Mexico in 94, or Argentina, or Russia, or Thailand, or Turkey, typically developing countries that fall into serious debt problems. And what I think we are in the midst of is something very similar, a serious debt crisis with very serious implications for the future. Debt crises are different than cyclical recessions. They're different for both economic reasons and for political reasons. And I'll come back to those reasons in a bit. But what I want to do first is summarize quickly as I can, how we got into the mess that we're in and what some of the broad international economic and political factors that led to the crisis look like. So it all starts around 2000-2001, and since Cal has given me a few extra minutes, I'll take it back a little further and say, those of you who can remember just not the interns. Those of you who can remember 2000, 2001 may recall that the overwhelming macroeconomic reality of 2000, 1999, 2000, 2001 in terms of macroeconomic policy is that the U.S. government, the federal government, was running massive surpluses. We had had deficits since the early 80s over a very difficult 1990s. Keep in mind, from 1994 onward, we have had a Democratic president, Republican House and Senate, bipartisan attempts, ultimately successful, to reduce spending and increase taxes, which meant that by 1997, the budget was in balance, and by the year 2000, our surplus was about almost $250 billion. And the Congressional Budget Office projected that if everything stayed as it was, by the year 2006, the federal government would have paid off its entire debt for the first time since 1836. All right. So this, in some quarters, this was seen as a bit of a problem. Alan Greenspan saw it as a problem. He talks about this in his memoirs. And the problem that he was concerned with was that the Fed operates its monetary policy by buying and selling Treasury securities. Well, if the Treasury, if the federal government has paid off its debt, there aren't many Treasury securities out there. And so the Fed would have had to use poor substitutes for Treasury securities to operate open market operations, like buying and selling things like World Bank bonds or private securities. And so that was seen as a problem. It was also seen as something of a problem by some, especially the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal was concerned about this, because if the federal government runs a surplus, pays off its debt, and continues to run a surplus, it has to accumulate assets. And it accumulates assets by buying assets in the private financial markets. And the concern was, well, do we really want the federal government going into the stock market and the bond market and buying hundreds of billions of dollars worth of private assets over the course of the future? So these were seen as the macroeconomic policy problems of the year 2000 or so, that the government had these massive surpluses, and we weren't quite sure what the broad implications of that would be. But as we know in retrospect, those problems were all solved with the stroke of a pen by George Bush in 2001 and again in 2003 with tax cuts that engineered the largest single turnaround in the fiscal position of the federal government in peacetime history, from a surplus of almost $250 billion to a deficit of about $400 billion. The vast majority of that deficit was financed from abroad, which is the first part of the story. So you have the government going from being in substantial surplus to being in very large deficit, which stimulates the economy. And that stimulus is funded by borrowing from the rest of the world, about 300 and some billion of the $400 billion deficit funded by borrowing from other countries, from investors and governments in other countries. In addition to the turnaround in fiscal policy, there was a substantial change in monetary policy. And of course, you had a brief recession in 2000-2001 associated with the collapse of the high-tech bubble. And then the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001, all of which led to concern about the state of the economy. The Fed pushed interest rates down to 1% and kept them there for a very long period, for over 3 years. At a time when, so interest rates were at about 1% for that more than 3 year period, at a time when inflation was 2, 2.5, maybe 3%. So we had negative real interest rates, again, for the longest time in peacetime, modern peacetime American history. So you have, on the one hand, a very stimulative fiscal policy, and on the other hand, you have a very loose monetary policy where interest rates, real interest rates, are extremely low, negative, giving people tremendous incentives to borrow. And with those incentives to borrow, households in particular began borrowing a lot and borrowing again from the rest of the world. So the way, if we think about the U.S. as an entity, starting around 2001, the U.S. starts borrowing hundreds of billions of dollars from the rest of the world to finance the federal budget deficit. And starting somewhat later, it starts borrowing other hundreds of billions of dollars from the rest of the world to finance household expenditures. Right? Between 2001 and 2007, the U.S. borrowed between $500 billion and $1 trillion a year, every year, from the rest of the world, adding up to a bit over $5 trillion. So that money flooded in, and the borrowing experience that we went through looked a lot like borrowing experiences in some of the countries that I mentioned before. We borrowed to finance a federal budget deficit, and we borrowed to finance household consumption, household spending. Right? So what does some of you who work on or have experience with these borrowing experiences in developing countries knows what it looked like? When money flows into a country, it has to be spent on something. So one thing that it's spent on is hard goods, things that can enter into international trade, things like cars or steel or computers or electronics. So you get a borrowing country, you get a big increase in imports. We got a surge in imports from $1.3 to $2.4 trillion a year, a doubling of our trade deficit. Right? So that's the first effect, or one of the first effects of this borrowing boom. The second thing that the money is spent on is goods that don't enter into international trade, right? Because the hard goods, you have an increased demand for them, that leads to an increase in imports. But then actually most of what people spend their money on is not hard goods. It's what we call non-tradables, things like services, things that don't enter into international trade. Because they don't enter into international trade, increased demand for them raises their price. Right? So if we start buying more steel from the rest of the world, it doesn't affect its price. But if we start buying more haircuts or more housing, for example, then the price does begin to rise. And so what we experience is first, as I said, a big increase in the trade deficit, and second, a big increase in the price of non-traded services, non-traded goods and services. Standard for any borrowing economy. Between 2001 and 2007, in fact, the price of durable goods in the U.S. went down 13%. The price of services went up 25%. The most important non-tradable good or service in the consumption basket of any country's household is housing. One-third of all American consumption, the spending of the average American household, is on shelter. Right? So as American households are feeling the stimulative effect of fiscal policy and are feeling the ability to borrow, whether for credit card debt or student debt or auto debt or for mortgages, right, you have a big increase in the demand for housing and the price of housing goes up. So we get a big increase in consumption, expansion of consumption. That expansion leads to a boom. That boom leads to a bubble, and the bubble eventually bursts. It's ironic to think about the context of this. So what we had in the U.S. was a debt finance consumption boom, right, where we borrowed trillions of dollars from the rest of the world, not for productive investment, not to invest in new factories or new productive facilities, but to invest in consumption, current consumption. And for decades, maybe even more, Americans and others have gone around the world to developing countries saying, if you're going to borrow, make sure you borrow only for productive investment. Don't borrow for purposes of current consumption, because that means you're not increasing the productivity of your economy. It's going to be very hard to pay off the debt. And it turns out those warnings were justified. We proved that they were justified by doing exactly what we've been telling other countries not to do for decades and got ourselves into real difficulties. But this is part of a global process. I mean, to try to tie this in not just to an American story but to a global story, because this past decade, the decade that ended in 2010, and the process that ended in 2008, was an unusual one in the international economy. There is a broad pattern of which the United States was part. In a sense, a division of the world into two broad groups of countries. One big group of countries, right, grew rapidly by borrowing to finance consumption. And that was not just the U.S., but it was the U.K., it was Ireland and Spain and Portugal and Greece and Italy and many countries in Central and Eastern Europe. So these are the deficit countries, the countries that borrow to finance consumption in the course of that 7 or 8 years. Another big group of countries grows by exporting. Right? So the engine of their economic growth is exporting to the consuming countries. And that would be China, Japan, a lot of countries in East Asia, and Northern European countries, Germany, first and foremost, Germany, the Netherlands, a lot of Scandinavian countries, but especially Germany. Germany is one of the big three exporters in this period. China, Japan, and Germany are the three big surplus countries in this period. And if you look at the national income accounts, the only growth area of the German economy after 2000 is in its exports. Right? China and Japan, it's well known that they've pursued a very export-oriented economic policy for the last 25 or 30 or more years in the case of Japan. But Germany in particular, after the 1990s, very heavily oriented towards exports. So you have a division of the world between countries that are exporting their way towards economic growth and other countries that are consuming the exports and borrowing to do it. So all of the this global process looks very similar in the surplus countries, among the surplus countries, and also in the deficit countries. So you often hear it said that there was a global housing bubble in the past decade. And that's true to an extent. Right? Ireland and Spain, for example, had even bigger housing bubbles than we did. I was in Dublin in 2007, and walking around middle-class neighborhoods in Dublin, which is a medium-sized city, there were modest, you look in the estate agent's windows, there were modest three-bedroom homes selling for 1.5 million euros, which is almost $2.5 million. And, you know, I'm from New York. The average house in Dublin in 2007 was more expensive than the average dwelling in apartment or house in Dublin was more expensive than the average dwelling in Manhattan. And Dublin, as I say, is a medium-sized city on a flat plain with no constraints on growth, no constraints on new building. It was nuts. So there had been a tripling of housing prices in Ireland in over a 10-year period, and an almost as big increase in housing prices in Spain. So there was a huge increase in housing prices in these countries, but it wasn't everywhere. These are the borrowing countries. That's where the housing prices increased. In Germany and Japan, over the course of the decade, housing prices actually declined, which is, again, what you would expect if money is flowing out of the country. Right? The same thing with consumption. Consumption as a share of GDP actually declined over this period in China, in Japan, and Germany, while it rose very dramatically in countries like the US, Spain, Italy, Ireland. Right? So with the collapse, so we have a global phenomenon where some countries are lending heavily to other countries. It leads, as most of these capital flow cycles do, to a boom, in this case, in many instances, a bubble that bursts. And now with the collapse, we have to unwind the process that got us into the trouble that we're in. In a way, one way to think about it is we borrowed from the rest of the world. We borrowed in order to be able to, we and the other main borrowers, the other principal borrowers, borrowed to be able to consume more than we produced. We borrowed in order to be able to invest more than we saved. And we borrowed so that our government could spend more than it took in. And when the borrowing stops, which it hasn't yet in the US, but it has in some other countries, you have to turn all those gaps around. You have to produce more than you consume. You have to save more than you invest, and the government has to take in more than it spends in current expenditures, which is the problem that the Central and Eastern European countries and some of the European countries face. But why is this so difficult? So again, why is a debt crisis different from a normal recession? I said there were both economic and political reasons. So the economic reasons are that there is, in the aftermath of a debt crisis, what we typically call a debt overhang. That is, that both the creditors and the debtors are left with massive bad debts on their books, trillions of dollars in bad debts. If we think of the United States, you've got financial institutions in the U.S. that are holding trillions of dollars of debts, some of which they know are bad, others of which they fear are bad. And given the great concern about the quality of the debts they're holding on their books, financial institutions are very reluctant to take new risks. Right? If you are concerned about the quality of your portfolio, you pull in your horns. You lend only to the least risky borrowers. Right. So the debt overhang affects creditors by making them relatively unwilling or much less willing to make new loans. True also in Europe, where the trillions of dollars extended to the peripheral European countries have left German, Dutch, French banks in very, very shaky conditions. Right? On the debtor side, debtors also have seen their balance sheets savaged, right? And they owe more money than they can, or than they counted on. Either they owe more money than they counted on having to pay back, or they own less assets than they counted on being able to use. Example here, if we think of, these are more or less real numbers, more or less meaning to a first approximation. If we think of the average American household in 2006, it is a couple, early 50s, kids out of the house, and they have a home worth $250,000, $250,000, and they also have $250,000 in retirement savings. So they're in their early 50s, they're looking forward to retirement, they've got a target for their retirement, the income that they need to be able to retire in the style to which they'd like to become accustomed, and they have a house which they anticipate being able to sell, right? So they can move into a condo or to Florida or to Southern California or wherever it may be. And they've got retirement savings, which in addition to their Social Security should keep them more or less in their current lifestyle. They wake up one day in 2008 and their house is now worth $150,000 and their retirement savings are also worth $150,000. They've still got the same aspirations for retirement, right? But now they're one-third poorer. their assets have been reduced in value by one-third approximately. So they have to dramatically cut back on their consumption and increase their savings in order to reach that retirement target. They may also plan to work 2, 3, 4 more years, right? And that means that on the debtor side, people are not as willing to spend. They're squirreling away resources to try to reconstitute or restore the quality of their own balance sheet. That's the economic effect of a debt crisis. It leads both debtors and creditors to try to restore their portfolios, their balance sheets, and that means that they're much less willing to spend, much less willing to lend and to spend, and that retards recovery. But as a political scientist, I would focus on the politics, right? Although the economics is important, the politics of the aftermath of a debt crisis are also daunting, because every debt crisis I know of and every debt crisis I can think of ends in political controversy over who will bear the burden of adjustment. So you have a debt crisis, you have an economy that's saddled with massive debts, some of which are bad, some of which will have to be written off, and the question is, who's going to sacrifice to try to restore the financial condition of the country? Typically, there are two dimensions of conflict, one, especially when you're talking about foreign debts. One dimension is the creditor countries versus the debtor countries, where, of course, the creditor countries want to be paid back, and the debtor countries want to pay as little as possible. But then we see that in Europe. We see Germany versus Greece, where the Germans want the burden of adjustment to be borne by the Greeks, and the Greeks want the burden of adjustment to be borne by the Germans. But we also see it within countries, because even within Greece or within Germany, there's a question as to whether the adjusting will be done by taxpayers, if there were any in Greece, or by government employees, or by the private sector, by the financial institutions. In Germany, the same thing. A lot of the conflict in Germany has to do with whether, if Germany does, in fact, agree to a restructuring of the debt that takes a hit out of German creditors, will that be picked up by the German taxpayer, by financial institutions, by private industry? Right? So political conflict is, in a sense, almost an inevitable result of the aftermath of a debt crisis, because the economies have to adjust. These debts are, it is universally understood that the debts that have accumulated will not be paid in the amounts contracted. Whether you're talking about American mortgage debt, we all know that because so many of the mortgages have already been written off, or you're talking about European sovereign debt. It is clear that those debts will not be serviced in the amounts that they're contracted with, and so who's going to pay? Will it be the creditors in a restructuring on the creditor side? Will it be the debtors? Will it be the creditor countries, the debtor countries? Who within countries will be asked to sacrifice? Right. I should point out that, as we were saying a little bit earlier, there are powerful incentives to work this out. The more uncertainty there is about how the crisis will be resolved, the longer it drags on and the more expensive it gets. We have a little bit of taste of this in the U.S. in the 1980s in the savings and loan crisis. Some of you will remember the savings and loan crisis. It was first identified by the Congressional Budget Office in 1982-83, at which point it estimated its cost at a few billion dollars, which, you know, not that much in the global sweep of things. But Congress and the President delayed for largely political reasons, not wanting to bite the bullet, not wanting to put banks out of business, not wanting to put the hit on the mortgage holders, not wanting to decide how the crisis would be resolved. By the time it was finally resolved in 88, 89, 90, it cost the taxpayer almost $150 billion. So the longer these crises go on without resolution, the more expensive they get, and the more of a drag they are on the economy more broadly. So there are tremendous incentives to resolve a crisis like this, as we can see in Europe. You know, Europe would be much better off if there were some resolution to its current debt problems. But the principal impediment is the political conflict over who, in fact, will make the sacrifices necessary for those conflicts to be resolved. So now let me say a little bit more about some of the politics of this and what underlies it. In the U.S., to start with the U.S., and we can, since I'll wind up in a few minutes, we can talk more about other countries in discussion. So in the U.S., as we know, I think, as we can see, just as in Europe, the political response to the crisis has been highly polarized, so highly polarized that to some extent, as in Europe, the policy response has been little short of gridlock. in the sense that we really haven't dealt directly with the implications of the crisis. And in my view, one of the reasons is that, to use the usual phrase from political science, where you stand depends on where you sit. What you think should be done about the crisis depends fundamentally on what your experience of the crisis has been, how hard it has hit you, and what the various proposals to deal with it mean for you. The effects of the crisis have been very heterogeneous. And so to look at that in some detail, let me go back a bit and say the backdrop against which this is played out is the overriding social reality of the U.S. in the past 30 or so years, which many of you will know, which is that the income distribution of the U.S. has become more unequal over time since the early 1970s. Right? Whether this is a good thing or a bad thing or a neutral thing is another matter. It is a fact. There are sort of two moments in it, the first in the 70s and 80s, where the principal effect is that the relative wage of unskilled American workers drops dramatically. And then starting in the 90s, there's a second period in which the big effect is that the top 10% separates from the middle classes, right? So there's been a lot of social science work on this, on what the implications of this are. In fact, Raghu Rajan, the former chief economist of the IMF, has a book called Fault Lines, which interprets the crisis in this context. I mean, his argument is that one of the reasons that you had such encouragement of borrowing, especially by the Bush administration, was that this was their way of addressing the social implications of the worsening income distribution. Whether that's right or not, this is the backdrop against which both the experience of the last decade and the experience of the crisis today has to be understood. So during we did have this expansion after 2001, but even during the expansion, the effects were very unequal. Two-thirds of the income growth realized between 2001 and 2007 went to the top 1% of the American income distribution. I hate to use that 1% because it's taken on a different connotation, but it's the data. It's the data I have, anyway. So if you look at that top 1%, which is households earning more than $400,000 a year, that top 1% in between 2001 and 2007 saw their incomes rise, on average, by 60%. Right? The remainder of American society, of American households, incomes rose by 6% over that period, which is not a very big rise, and which was wiped out by the recession. Right? So even in the good times, there was a certain inequality or heterogeneity in the experience of the crisis. But during the crisis, the effects are in some ways even more uneven, largely tracking skill levels. And as Ed was saying earlier when we were talking over lunch. So one way of seeing this is in the differential impact of unemployment. At its trough, unemployment in the country as a whole was a little bit about 9.9%. Right? At that point, so let's think about the country as a whole. Now divide the labor force into thirds. The bottom third of the labor force, which is a lot of people. If you think of the workers and their dependents and families, you're talking about 100 million people. So the bottom third of the labor force, which is households earning under about $45,000 a year. The unemployment rate was 18% at that point. And now if you add in, as for some reasons you'd want to, add in the underemployment rate, which is essentially made up of part-time employment, that is people who would like to work full-time but can't find full-time jobs, so they're working part-time, and then discouraged workers, people who have been out of work for 2 years or more and have stopped looking for work and are outside the labor force. So if you add the underemployment rate to the unemployment rate, for that bottom third of the labor force, the unemployment plus underemployment rate was 36%, which is the set depression levels, more or less depression levels. Now you look at the top third of the labor force, that is these households earning above $75,000 or $80,000 a year. So at the same time, 18%, 36% in the bottom third, the unemployment rate for the top third is 4%, and the unemployment plus underemployment rate is 8%, which is higher than it is usually, but certainly nowhere near the crisis levels of the bottom third. So you can understand in that context why it is that some Americans would say that the government was doing too little, and other Americans would say the government's doing too much. Especially those in the upper third might say, why should we sign off on the government accumulating huge deficits to deal with that we're going to have to pay for, because we're the taxpayers, after all, it's where the taxes come from, when the crisis is really not having that terrible an effect on us. There's also a geographical component as well, as you well know, in Southern California, where some regions of the country did not have as big a housing boom or bubble as others and have not had as big a housing collapse. I mean, in Massachusetts, for example, housing prices on average went up about 20% over the course of the decade, and they've gone down about 5%. You know, unemployment in Massachusetts as a whole is 6% today. In the Boston area, it's around 5%. While in Nevada, it's three times that level, two or three times that level. And, of course, the housing crisis in places like Nevada and other regions are much more severe. But in the U.S., the divisions, this heterogeneity in these divisions are not primarily regional, because we have a tradition of being one country. People in Massachusetts are not saying, let the lazy Southern Californians or the lazy Nevadans pay back their debts, we're not going to bail them out. But they do in Europe, right? So in Europe, the conflict and the both the heterogeneity and the distributional conflicts and the gridlock takes this interstate component, this interstate character. And in a way, that becomes much more serious, especially in the European context. So we have in the U.S., a polarization to some extent in the political space between those who think the government should do less and those who think the government should do more, or people who think the government should do different things, want the government to intervene on the side of the creditors or on the side of the debtors, whatever it may be. In the European context, this has, in very dramatic ways, in ways which in some ways threaten the entire European integration project, pitted not only countries but groups of countries against one another. The conflicts in between Northern and Southern Europe are severe. They are continuing. They show no early sign of resolution. They resemble a very dangerous game of chicken, where each side is trying to hold out for a better deal in the context of a gathering and ever-worsening economic crisis, and a crisis which will have very long-term effects. You know, there are countries in Europe that have now had 5 years of youth unemployment above 50%. So that means that there are entire sub-generations of young people who have never had a job. Right? And that has a lasting impact on both skill levels, on social and other sociological facts, and on politics. So Europe faces a particularly virulent version of this strife over the distribution of the burden of adjustment. It's not just that it has prolonged and will prolong the crisis, it's that it will have lasting effects on social and political affairs within Europe. So, to finish up, this has been and is a classic debt crisis that has affected the world's two largest economies, the U.S. on the one hand and the European Union on the other. It's hard to imagine how a massive debt crisis affecting the world's two largest economies would not have devastating global effects, and it has. These purely economic effects have, over the past few years, been exacerbated by the eruption of major political conflicts, by political impasse in both the U.S. and the European Union, both within countries and across countries. So, not to be too pessimistic, but I think we can infer that there are troubled times ahead. So, on that happy note, I'll stop and throw the floor open for comments, questions. Sure.
Hi. You asked us a very serious question. How did we get into this mess? That's a very profound question. If I give an answer in 30 seconds, maybe
okay.
You can turn me.
Okay.
The main
I'm
answer
counting.
Is, as President Kennedy said, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. My question is, what does Americans do for our country rather than government should end the recession, government give us a job, do that, but they never say what they were willing to do for the country. Now, 20 seconds. After the Second War, Germany and Japan was in a dire economic recession, and U.S. government said, okay, you still need our aid, so we'll give you free goods. We'll give you a real goods in cheaper price. And German and Japanese people say, no, thank you. We have to make our own. It might be more expensive. It make more time. It's harder for us. But we have to create jobs so that we can have our own job. So by doing so, people are willing to do that. So by doing so, Japan obtained the number two economic power. Germany came number three economic power. Now the Chinese became number two economic power. Why? Because they make goods, they export more than they import. Now U.S. is now is a chip. I can buy more. There is no end to it. You cannot any business. You cannot survive when you spend more than buying it. You know. So what American people can do?
Okay. So I don't think that any component of the crisis is due to people not being willing to work. There are plenty of people out there. I mean, what we have today is a very high level of involuntary unemployment, where there are people looking for jobs who can't find jobs. So I don't think it's a question of unwillingness to work. I think you raise an interesting point about exports or about trade relations. There's nothing magical about selling more to the rest of the world than we buy, and in fact, what we did over the course of the last decade is borrow in order to consume. Now, let me be clear. There's nothing necessarily wrong with borrowing. Right? Firms borrow, countries borrow, and there are perfectly good economic reasons to borrow. Generally, you know, if GE borrows, but it only makes sense to borrow, which is the counterpart of running a trade deficit. It only makes sense to borrow if you're using the borrowed funds for purposes that are going to earn more than the rate of interest on the loan. So if you're GE and you borrow at 10% and your investment pays off 15%, both you and the lender are happy. But if you're GE and you borrow at 10% and your investment pays off at 5% or 0%, then you're unhappy. And that's the point that I was trying to make before, which is that the borrowing that was done in the past 10 years in the U.S. and in many other countries did not go, largely, to investment in productive capacity that increases the country's ability to produce goods and services and therefore service its debts, which is, you know, sort of the first lesson one learns about borrowing. There's an interesting comparison. So in between 96 and 2000, the country was also running a current account deficit. That is, we were borrowing from the rest of the world, nowhere near as much as we did after 2001, about 2%, 2.5% of GDP on average. But if you look at the sectoral balances, the slide here shows this. If you look at the sectoral balances, between 1996 and 2000, the government is in surplus, so the government's not borrowing from the rest of the world. The household sector is more or less in balance, and almost all the borrowing is being done by the non-financial corporate sector. Right, which is the high-tech boom. This is money is flowing into the country from the rest of the world to finance the high-tech boom. Now, you can say what you want about the high-tech boom of the late 90s. A lot of it was a bubble. There was a bubble aspect to it. But a lot of it also went into very substantial investments in high technology, some of which we're still living off of, research and development in the high-tech industries. After 2000, 2001, it turns around. The corporate sector, the non-financial corporate sector, is in surplus after 2001. The government goes into a large-scale deficit, and then it is followed by the household sector. So that's an indication that we went from borrowing to finance private investment in productive activities to borrowing to finance a budget deficit that, in my view, was not really justifiable on economic terms, and household borrowing largely for current consumption. So where I would, to some extent, agree with you is that the source of the problem is borrowing for reasons that are hard to justify economically. But, you know, it's not, I mean, I guess there's a moralizing aspect to a lot of these discussions that I don't buy into. It's when it makes sense for a household to borrow, households borrow. I would say it's not really the fault of households for borrowing when real interest rates are negative. If you're going to look for fault, I'd say it's caused by government policy. It's government policy that creates conditions for people to do things that are potentially damaging for the macroeconomy as a whole. So I don't really buy the notion that all we need to do is just be willing to work harder. There are plenty of people who can't find jobs at all, and that's a macroeconomic problem. And whether it makes sense for us to run a trade surplus or not, I mean, I think that matters a lot less than having an economy that is actually productive and engaging in investments that are productive. The next hand I saw was Larry's.
Yeah, some countries outside of the European and American spheres seem to have less impact of the debt crisis.
Right.
And the example that's often given is Brazil. And that Brazil's position actually improved during part of the first decade.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps the scenario was a little bit too rosy, though, and then some economic analytic groups even said that by the year 2050 that Brazil will have the fourth largest economy in the world. How do you assess...
As Russia sinks beneath the waves, is that the idea?
How do you assess what's gone on in Brazil,
right,
and what the prospects are?
Yeah, so what about Brazil? Right? And Brazil is a fascinating example, and in some way it's emblematic of a range of countries, largely in Latin America, but not only, that prospered during this period and have continued to do well. In a way, Brazil... The question about Brazil brings in an angle that I haven't talked about, but I'd be happy to if someone asked a question, hint, hint, which is China. So why did Brazil grow as rapidly as it did in the past 10 years? It grew largely because of China, in a both direct way and an indirect way. The indirect way is China's growing very rapidly. As China grows rapidly, it increases demand for raw materials, for primary commodities, and there's a big commodity boom. So Brazil has a big increase in the prices of its principal exports, which are commodities like iron ore and things of that nature. And that helps a lot. It also helps on a volume side. That is that Brazil now is selling in the year, let's see if I remember the data more or less correctly. In the year 2000, the Brazilians sold 10 times as much to the U.S. as they did to China. Last year, they sold twice as much to China as they did to the U.S., so there's a big reorientation of Brazilian, not just Brazilian commodity producers generally, of Brazilian exports away from the U.S. and Northern Europe and Western Europe towards China as China grows so rapidly. And when an economy is doubling every 6 or 7 or 8 years, and especially an economy that is not resource rich, it sucks in primary commodities from the rest of the world. And China's been doing that. So Brazilian growth, to some extent, is strongly reliant upon Chinese growth. And Chinese growth is strongly reliant on the Chinese ability to continue to export massive quantities of manufactured products to North America and Western Europe. And that's the big question for not only for China, but for Brazil. Right? Will China be able, over the next 10, 15, 20 years, to continue to pursue the development policy, the economic strategy that it has pursued with such success for the last 30 years, which requires that they can continue to sell into the American, North American, and Western European markets. So I would say that, on the one hand, Brazil has had some great successes. And I guess I should temper it by saying it's not just the commodity exports. They've been very successful at improving the infrastructure. There have been some very interesting and innovative social programs which have improved the income distribution in Brazil, which increases the size of the domestic market. They've improved the quality of the domestic financial system. So there's been some major progress made in Brazil. But if it had not been for the big terms of trade improvement, both in the improvement in the prices of their exports and the big access to the Chinese market, they would not have grown anywhere near as rapidly. And so the question for Brazil and countries like it going forward is, can you keep growing if you don't have access to this booming Chinese market? And that is a big question, I think. Yes.
I hate to quote the comedians, but in the 80s and 90s, Mel Brooks and Paul Reiner in The 2,000-Year-Old Man, Mel Brooks said, sell America. I mean, literally, sell. So these hard assets, homes, other things, AMC movies was just bought by a Chinese company. We went through it with the Japanese, where mm-hmm. everybody was in terror. The Japanese are going to own everything. They bought Pebble Beach, Rockefeller Center, downtown L.A.
And it all collapsed. We're glad to have them buy it.
This all self-correcting. And we also, today's Wall Street Journal had a picture of Made in America is making a comeback. The gradients are less for mm-hmm. importing and more for the domestic manufacturing.
Well, so those are two related points. Let me start with the last one. So one of the things that happened in the course of the last decade is as we're borrowing so heavily from the rest of the world, as prices are rising, you know, housing prices and things like that are rising, it starts pricing American manufacturers out of world markets. You know, if real estate prices, housing prices, wages are rising, people are borrowing to increase consumption, it makes American wages higher and harder. American manufacturers find it harder to compete. As that's turned around, wages start declining, and it makes American hard goods producers more competitive. And so that's one of the bright, I'm not sure how bright it is, one of the brighter spots in the U.S. economy has in fact been the manufacturing sector, because real wages have been declining. The cost of doing business in the U.S. has been declining. That's one of the things that happens in a crisis, right? So that's the first point. The second point about assets, there's a big difference between foreigners owning hard assets in the U.S. and cross-border loans, right? And what we have today is primarily, there's certainly a lot of foreign direct investment in the U.S., just as there's like a lot of Northern European direct investment in Southern Europe. But the crux of the crisis is financial. That is, that there are Northern European and other financial institutions, investors, pension funds, who have extended trillions of dollars to the U.S. government, to American financial institutions, and want to get paid back. So that then, when you, a direct investor knows, if you buy a factory in the U.S. or you buy a building in the U.S. and it goes down in price, that's your problem. But when you've lent money, there's a contractual obligation there. And that's a contractual obligation that has to be bargained out either in court or in politics. So that's one of the reasons that these cross-border debts are so deeply political. Cross-border direct investments tend not to be quite so political because, you know, you take the risk. You buy a mine in Chile, you take the risk that copper prices are going to go down. You buy a factory in the U.S., you take a risk on that. You lend money to Citibank, you expect to be paid back as contracted.
Right. 20 years ago, Germany was considered a welfare state with over 10% unemployment. How did they make that transition to where they are today?
Mm-hmm. So 20 years ago, Germany was in the midst of reunification. Right. It still is a welfare state, by the way. So that hasn't changed. The social welfare state in Germany hasn't changed. What has changed is the underlying macroeconomics. So they reunified. They borrow massive amounts of money, tens of trillions of trillions of dollars, in order to fund reunification. And as a result, part of what happens, among many other things, is that their wages rise. And they're uncompetitive on world markets. They start running big deficits because the deficit spending has increased wages above productivity, especially since they're artificially raising the wages of people in Eastern Germany. So we could talk about that particular experience, but you reach the 93-94 period and the Germans are in trouble, and what they do is say, okay, in order to adjust, we're going to have to cut wages. In real and absolute terms. And so the Germans impose very severe wage restraint. And really, since the mid-90s, real wages in Germany have been stagnant. Right? And consumption in Germany has gone down as a share of GDP. And that's part of it, in some ways, not to put too fine a point on it, it's analogous to the Chinese story. What the Germans counted on as a way of recovering from this shock of incorporating 18 or 20 million Eastern Germans was being able to export their way out of the recession and into economic growth, being able to produce goods that they would sell mostly to other Europeans, but also to the rest of the world. To do that, they had to restrain wages. They had to cut wages and keep them low. And that's what they've done. So the secret of German export success, as the secret of most export success, I mean, you can't be very successful exporting if your wages are rising more rapidly than your productivity. So the secret of German export success is wage restraint. Right? Now, it's hard to fault someone or fault a country for wage restraint, but in the context of Western Europe, again, without taking a position on this, the German ability to export their way out of their difficulties depended on the willingness and ability of other European countries to buy their goods. The question going forward is, who's going to buy their goods? It's not going to be the Greeks, the Spaniards, maybe not the Italians, right? So German export growth was heavily concentrated in the Eurozone and the areas around it, and that export growth is unlikely to return to its pre-2007 levels. So Germany faces a difficulty where the previous source of its principal economic growth, that is exports, is unlikely to be available in the next 10 years or so. By the way, China faces the same problem. China's economic success has depended on exports. It's run massive It's run, exported huge amounts of manufactured products to Western Europe and North America, and there is a fundamental question as to whether it's going to be able to return to that kind of export-led growth in this very changed period.
You began talking about the heterogeneous effects.
Right.
And you used the example, and I knew that region in the beginning.
Right.
You used the example of Massachusetts and Nevada. What is Massachusetts, or what was Massachusetts doing differently from Nevada? Because it seems that it's intuitively that the supply of housing would be less elastic there than it was in
It is to some extent, but again, largely, so the simple or superficial answer is population growth. You know, Nevada is a rapidly growing area, and Massachusetts is, I wouldn't say a stagnant area, but it's not, its population has basically been more or less constant with a little bit of growth for 30 or 40 years. So the big difference is rapid growth. Now, it's true that in the medium run, housing supply is more elastic in a place like Nevada, but in the short run, it's pretty inelastic, and especially if you're growing as rapidly as a place like Nevada was, right? There's also the expectational factor, which is Nevada, a place like Nevada or South Florida, parts of Southern California, where you've had 5-7 years of very rapid growth where housing prices are going up 10-12% a year, people expect them to continue to go up at that level, and so that's impounded into the prices, right? So that would be a part of the answer. The analogy with Europe is sort of interesting. There's a self-reinforcing character to this. You have somewhat more rapid growth in Spain. Let's take the European example, and then we can bring it back to the U.S. Somewhat more rapid growth in 2000, 2001 in Spain than in Germany. Germany is really not growing at all at that period. So the investment opportunities are in Spain. So capital flows from Germany to Spain. As capital flows from Germany to Spain, growth heats up even further in Spain. Prices rise, especially housing prices rise. That gives greater incentive for even more investment in housing, more borrowing, and so there's a self-reinforcing character to the cycle. And the same thing, I think, is largely true in places like parts of Southern California, Nevada, South Florida. A lot of the housing stock that was invested in that period was invested in on spec. Right? So...
So it seems to me that the economic crisis in the United States is part of the reason it's not being solved is because of the political polarity. And so I'm just wondering, what do you think will help the government to come together to fix this? Is it that this is a cyclical thing and eventually people will become more moderate? Or is it going to take a huge, terrible crisis in order for the government
That's what the old line is. I prefer to predict the past rather than the future. The honest and simple answer is I have no idea. I think there historically, when we face polarization of this sort, typically it's a really severe, disastrous crisis that takes us out of it. I certainly hope that isn't necessary this time. I mean, the Great Depression of the 1930s, it wasn't really until effectively there was a massive run on the dollar and a massive run on the banks and the economy was in a state of collapse and we had 25% unemployment before. And even then it was, you know, what Roosevelt did was very controversial. Similar serious crisis did not lead to such positive effects in other countries in 1933. So I wouldn't count on that as a positive outlet to the crisis. I think if I would be somewhat more optimistic, there a lot of the polarization, depending on who you believe, there is a cast of characters in political science who argue that the polarization that we observe in the U.S. is not primarily in the mass public, but rather between the political parties and among politicians. That is, that as a way of garnering support and particularly of mobilizing more activists who tend to be more extreme than the average voter, the median voter, the politicians sort of encourage this polarization. If that's the case, then perhaps the passing of an electoral season, although we always seem to be in electoral season, I don't know, it might help. I think this doesn't sound like an optimistic thing to say, but the threat of more severe imminent crisis might be enough to concentrate the minds of at least the more sensible component parts of the two political parties. But that's all. I mean, as I say, that's just a long-winded way of saying I don't know. So.
As a professor, last time when I went to the Roland Fraser's Center, which I'm for campus, I for a lot. And he mentioned that as the interaction between large firms is a factor for creating crisis that we're facing today. So do you think that those interconnections are, I mean, they cannot be cut off? And
I didn't quite get the question.
You mentioned that the interconnection between large firms as they protect each other to create platforms is a factor of the financial crisis we're facing today.
Okay.
And you think the connection cannot be cut off.
Mm-hmm.
And my second question is that, I mean, China as a major export country, the average household cost is like rising by almost 300% in large cities. But, I mean, it's not an import country, so how do you explain that?
Again, I didn't understand the question. So China's a major exporter, but...
But it's average... the average household spending on housing rise almost by 300%.
Household prices.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so a couple of things. On the large firms, I'm not quite sure what you're referring to. It's the main safety net that people have pointed to in the current crisis is not so much one among firms as it is the role of the federal government. I mean, the federal government, largely, especially with respect to finance is different than other industries. I mean, the modern economy depends on a functioning financial system, so all major governments play some role in either implicitly or explicitly backstopping the financial system. That then creates a problem because it means that banks have at least some belief that they're likely to be, as the current phrase goes, too big to fail, and they take more risks than they should, which then gives the government an incentive and the right to regulate them to try to avoid that they take risks that they shouldn't. So that's a problem, and it is part of the problem that got us into the current difficulty, is that it's almost certainly the case that in the U.S., at least, that a lot of the financial activities undertaken in the past 10 years were not adequately regulated by the federal government or by the regulators. But I don't think of that as being central to the current problems that we face, except that it's really difficult to figure out how to regulate a modern financial system in a way that's both that allows the financial system to operate efficiently and that avoids taking on too much risk on behalf of the taxpayer. With respect to China, I don't think housing prices have tripled. Maybe in some sectors they've tripled. Housing prices have risen in China, and that is a result, and this is part of the process that I was talking about before, the result of the impact of rapid growth. So you have to ask yourself, on a variety of dimensions, is the Chinese, the growth strategy the Chinese have pursued for the last 30 years sustainable going forward? And there are two aspects to that. Actually, there are more than two, but at least two aspects to that. The first is international. That is, are the markets that have been so open to Chinese goods and so willing to consume large quantities of Chinese goods likely to be willing to absorb them for the next 10 years? And my answer would be not likely, that there is, whether because of reduced consumption, reduced income, or increased protectionism, and we've just seen it in the case of the relatively minor case of solar panels in the case of the U.S., but whether as a result of any of those things, markets are going to be much less forgiving to Chinese exports than they have been. But then there's the domestic side. And the domestic side has both both economic and political components. On the economic side, rapid growth means that there are lots and lots of people in China whose incomes have risen. Right? And as their incomes rise, they want to buy more stuff. As they want to buy more stuff, prices start to rise. And the inevitable effect, which the Chinese have tried very, very hard to avoid by dampening down, is that prices and wages start to rise. They've risen much more slowly in China than they would in a more standard market economy, but there is an underlying pressure on prices and wages to rise. We've already seen that China is by no means the lowest wage location in East Asia. A lot of the lowest wage manufacturing in the area has moved to Vietnam and Bangladesh and places like that as wages have risen in China. There's also a domestic political component to it because Chinese development strategy has largely relied upon restraining wages, restraining consumption, in order to throw resources into the export sector. And there is a sort of annoying social and political view, widely held, especially among the urban middle classes in China, that government policy has not allowed Chinese people, or many Chinese people, to realize the full benefits of Chinese economic growth. The economy's grown 7, 8, 10% a year, but consumption and has only grown 3 or 4% a year. So although that's better than stagnation, right, the fact is that a lot of people in China feel that a change in policy would like to see less spent on encouraging growth in the manufactured export sector, which is regionally specific and specific to particular firms and groups in the economy, and see prosperity more widely spread. So there are both domestic economic and domestic political impediments to China continuing to pursue the growth policies that it has for the last 30 years. And the broad picture is this pattern that I described of the past 10 years, whether on the surplus side or on the deficit side, in my view, is not sustainable in the future. And we haven't found the new pattern. We haven't found new ways of growing national economies or the world economy that rely on different ways of interacting. And that's a problem not just for the U.S., not just for Southern Europe. It's a problem for Germany. It's a problem for Japan. It's a problem for China.
The Federal regulation is still doing derivatives. The Bank of International Settlements. How does this play into this, and how does it play into the currencies? All this new things going through the Dodd-Frank special.
Yeah. Well, these are all attempts to close various barn doors after horses are out cavorting in the field. There is a sense, and I think it's justified, that at least part of the crisis, part of the cause of the crisis, can be ascribed to lax financial regulation, right? So here, let me say a little bit about that. I think, so if you think of countries, whether it's the U.S. or Spain or Greece, borrowing very heavily from the rest of the world, in and of itself, that's not the problem. The problem is what the money is used for. And if financial regulators are signing off on banks lending money irresponsibly, in ways that, you know, are not going to, then financial regulators bear some responsibility. Right? One of the reasons I think that, so that's part of the explanation. I think that it's not a full explanation for a variety of reasons. First of all, you can look at a country like Spain. Spain had very stringent bank regulation, and yet they got themselves into the same kind of problem that we did as capital flowed into the country. And second, one of the reasons that regulation became so lax in the U.S., got more lax over time, was that the banks had so much money, they had funds available from foreign lenders. So they have these trillions of dollars, and they want to lend it out, and they go to the regulators and say, allow us to lend out these funds to riskier borrowers. Allow us to leverage up more than we have. So in a sense, the pressure to relax regulation is a result of this capital inflow. But that's talking about the causes. There is a general sense on the part of many that regulation was too lax and should be made more stringent, and more stringent particularly in the way that I was just saying, that inasmuch as every major government has an implicit or explicit responsibility to backstop the financial system, it can't let the financial system collapse, then if it doesn't keep financial institutions from doing things that put the entire system at risk, it's going to end up with the taxpayers footing the bill. So that gives the government a responsibility and the right to say, you're not allowed to do things that risk putting taxpayer money at risk. The problem is, it's not clear how to do that. No one really knows in today's highly interconnected, globalized financial markets where innovation is almost instantaneous. It's not really clear what is too risky. It's not clear what risks have been covered by insurance or other contracts. I mean, a lot of people felt that some of the financial innovations of the last decade were in fact protecting us from some of these risks. They turned out some of the financial innovations that were supposed to be the best insurance against these risks turned out to be the riskiest. So Ed Cain talks, finance economist, talks about the regulatory dialectic, where the regulators step in to try to reduce risk, and it then becomes profitable for the financial institutions to find ways to come up with new instruments that aren't regulated. It's not illegal. They just say, okay, well, if you're going to tightly regulate A, I'll find B. And that, so the regulators are always chasing after the financial institutions. It makes it extremely difficult to know what the right way to react is. Now, I'm no expert in financial regulation, thank goodness, because it's really complicated. I do think that there are certain basic principles that were disregarded in the last decade that almost everyone agrees need to be paid more attention to. And one is that, I mean, to take an example, that if a financial institution, that financial institution subsidiaries have to be incorporated in what financial institutions are responsible for. One of the things that happened after 2003 was that American banks set up subsidiaries, vehicles, that were allowed to borrow much more heavily with less capital than the banks themselves. And so, in a sense, Goldman Sachs or Citibank set up institutions, financial vehicles, that were able to take on much greater risk than the banks themselves were allowed to. And it was essentially an accounting trick. And so there's widespread agreement that those kinds of accounting tricks should be prohibited. And that's what the BIS, the latest BIS settlements, are largely about that. But, I mean, I'm a little bit skeptical that the regulators are ever really going to be able to catch up with today's financial markets, which is why I think that instead of dealing with the financial aspects, which are very difficult, I mean, there are many more financial analysts working for financial institutions, and they're much more highly paid than there are regulators in the world. So I sort of think the regulators are always going to be chasing after them. I think that the better response or the better preventive measures are on macroeconomic policy rather than financial regulation. But that's just my personal opinion. Not that I think that better regulation is a bad thing. Yes.
I have a question. First, I want to quote the Joker from The Dark Knight.
Okay.
The first scene when he meets Batman in the interrogation room, and he's fighting and they're talking, he goes, "Those mob fools want you gone so they can get back to the way things were. But I know the truth. There's no going back. We've changed things forever."
Right, okay.
And the reason I brought this up was I feel like a lot of people on the right wing and the left wing in this election season will talk about how to get America back to the way things were because we want to see those times of prosperity.
Right.
But like you, I know the truth. Things are going to be different.
You, I, and the Joker, right?
Right. I'm curious because from a political aspect, you're going to be seeing a lot of double speak this next few months, and a lot of people are going to be sold a lot of false hope. And I know you never give good news because you're economists and political scientists. But
dismal science and all that.
Start with like, how can you get people to think differently about
where
this country's going in terms of where capitalism should be going, where global governance should be going?
Yeah.
Because those are the questions of the future that we're not addressing.
Well, that that's if I knew the answer to that question, my view is that. As an academic who works on these issues, the best thing I can do is to try to provide an analysis which I think is more rooted in reality than what is provided by a lot of the current political discourse. I mean, it's very frustrating to listen to the political debates, and this is a nonpartisan statement, right? It's very difficult to listen to these political debates, especially about economic policies, without just grinding my teeth, because, as you say, they are essentially unhinged from reality. And that's not only true of the U.S., it's true of what's going on in Europe as well. I mean, the way the whole Eurozone crisis has been presented to mass publics, whether it's Merkel in Germany or the Greeks or the Italians or the Spaniards, it bears virtually no relationship to the real choices that people and economies and governments and countries face. And it's incredibly frustrating. And so, you know, if my weak defense is to say, you know, when, as I sometimes do, I try to write for a more general audience, and I think a lot of us do, we try to say, okay, here is a more accurate way to think about these problems and hope that people listen. But, you know, what can I say? Yes?
So when you talk about a more accurate way to think of these problems, you talk about the problem of during growth, the United States has a large separation between the top and the middle. So, like right now, there's a large political focus on tax policy, which during Clinton's talk on campus a few weeks ago, he kind of brushed off saying it's completely like a red herring. It's not at all what we should be going after. We should be going after income disparity and stuff like that. Do you think there's a political conversation we should be having or something to address that if you even go in growth? Because I know that's been separate.
I think there are two interrelated questions here. The first is, And this gets back to the previous point. It seems impossible for political debate to separate the short run from the long run. I don't quite know why that's true, except that maybe for politicians there is no long run. We have a serious short-term problem, and the principal short-term problem we have is trying to get the economy growing again. And the Europeans, of course, have an even more severe short-term problem. So, long-term, we also have a number of serious problems, one of which is fiscal. You know, we face some very serious, looking 15, 20 years down the line, some very serious fiscal constraints, especially with respect to Medicare, less so with Social Security. And then there's the longer run question of not just income disparity, but skill disparity. The fact that in the minds of many, including some very intelligent economists, the United States, the labor force in the U.S. is really, on average, not as a total, it's on average unprepared for a lot of the economic opportunities and activities of the 21st century, which is really about education, right? So instead of trying to have a rational discussion of that, what we end up with is people focusing on short-term fiscal problems, which are really not a big issue. I mean, the short-term problem is growth, and ignoring the long-term fiscal problems and the long-term educational problems. And that, again, that's very frustrating. So my, you know, if you ask for a different way to think about the problems, I think that we have to simultaneously try to address the short-term macroeconomic problems that we face, which are largely about growth, and figure out which of these, how we're going to deal with the longer-term problems. And on, you know, on fiscal policy, I don't care, raising taxes, cutting spending, which spending we should cut. I mean, the one thing that I think is that we should not be arguing about is how to get there. That what we should be, Americans seem to have gotten in the habit of believing that whatever it is that we want the government to spend money on, we don't have to pay for it, right? And so because we can borrow ad infinitum. And that is erroneous. It's you know, yes, we can borrow now. The U.S. government can still borrow at very low rates, but that is not a long-term solution to our problems. The longer-term questions that we should be asking are about our priorities for public policy, you know, not who should be paying the taxes or how much they should be paying or what do we want the federal government to be doing? What do we want government in general to be doing? If people want to spend more on national defense, fine, pay for it. If people want to spend more on education, fine, pay for it. If they want to spend less on those things, pay for it. If they want to figure out how to deal with the Medicare problem, you know, do that. But these kind of sort of simple nostrums that are bandied about in the political debates just have nothing to do with addressing the underlying problems. Sorry to pontificate, but that's it. Cal, I got one more question. Oh, that's so terrible. Go ahead.
Okay. I want to talk about the consequences of the debt crisis.
Okay.
There has been recent discussions over China potentially dumping U.S. Treasury bills, and I was wondering if that fear is actually rational in the standpoint of the United States, and what would happen if China does decide to pursue.
So what happens if China starts selling off its treasury securities? Well, they lose a lot of money is what happens, because they are a major holder of treasury securities. They have a fairly large share of the treasury market. So if they start selling, prices go down, right? And that hurts them. So it's unlikely that they would simply dump their treasury securities. If you ask the broader question, I mean, Keynes has a famous line, which, being British at the time, I should translate it into modern American, but his line was, if you owe the local bank manager £1,000, it's your problem. If you owe him £1,000,000, it's his problem, right? So the implication is that the money that we owe the Chinese is both of our problem. They are on the hook for a lot of money, and their government has invested over $1.5 trillion in treasury and agency securities in the U.S. They can't dump them without losing a lot of money on those sales. That means that there is some scope for some attempt at a resolution of the problem or of the issue that can be bargained out, just maybe to split the difference. We are unlike the Southern European or peripheral Southern. I hate Southern European because that sort of moves Ireland 500 miles south. But the peripheral European problem is much more severe than the American problem, because the peripheral Europeans have found themselves in what's called a sudden stop. They sort of stopped being able to borrow all at once, and that means that all of a sudden they've got to adjust. We don't have that problem yet, but it is not improbable, which means it's probable. It is probable that at least at some point, if we continue along this path, that we will start facing more and more difficulties borrowing. It doesn't mean people are going to stop lending to us, but it almost certainly means that the price we'll have to pay to borrow will go up. Right. And as that happens, you know, it's in the interest of both the creditors and the debtors to try to work out an amicable resolution of the problem. So I don't think that we're over a barrel with the Chinese holdings of treasury securities. I think, in a sense, to some extent, we're all in the same, to mix metaphors, we're not over a barrel, we're all in the same boat together. That is, that this is a problem, a joint problem faced both by the Chinese and the Japanese and the U.S. and the Western Europeans. This is a global economic problem. It's not the problem of one country or another country. Just as the debt problem in Europe is not a problem of Greece or Spain, it's a problem of Europe as a whole. The global macroeconomic problems are truly global, and we're all in it together.
Thank you
all. Thank you.